So this is the actual title of the talk. I'll tell you about decoherence and quantum state measurement in quantum optics. The outline of the talk will be the following. First, I'll introduce decoherence to you, and then I'll tell you about decoherence experiments in cavity QED, and also about how you can measure the quantum state of the electromagnetic field. I'll tell you about the Wigner distribution, I'll summarize the theory, and tell you about some recent experiments which have measured the Wigner function of an electromagnetic field. And I'll also tell you about the relationship between the Wigner distribution and the decoherence problem. And finally, I'll mention some perspectives for the near future. Now, the problem of decoherence is actually connected to an old questions in quantum mechanics. Schrödinger considered the existence of quantum interference at the microscopic level as something that necessarily should imply that the same phenomenon should exist between distinguishable macroscopic states. And that was the basis of his famous Schrödinger's cat paradox. Einstein, in a letter to Born in 1954, stated that he considered a fundamental problem of quantum mechanics the inexistence at the classical level of the majority of states allowed by quantum mechanics, namely coherent superpositions of two or more macroscopically localized states. And these questions are actually connected to von Neumann's collapse postulate and the quantum mechanical measurement problem. According to which, there are two distinct types of evolution in quantum mechanics. First, the deterministic and unitary evolution corresponding to the Schrödinger equation, and second, the probabilistic and irreversible process associated with measurement. And if you consider that the quantum measurement apparatus should also be described by quantum mechanics, it's not clear where the separation between the deterministic and unitary evolution and the probabilistic and irreversible process should be placed. That's sometimes called the Heisenberg cut. And therefore, one of the problems is really to understand the separation between these two situations. So let me start by just reviewing the quantum measurement problem in a way which will be useful for our presentation. And it, as you are going to see, we'll have several, in several places, we'll make contact with this discussion in the beginning of the talk. Now, so suppose you have a measurement apparatus, it has a pointer, and you use it to measure the state of a two-level system, which could be a spin, or it could be a two-level atom, an atom which can be in either of the two states. And what this apparatus says is in which state is the atom. Now, if the atom is in the upper state, then the pointer points towards one direction. If the atom is in the other state, then the pointer points towards the other direction. Now, quantum mechanics is a linear theory. Therefore, if you prepare the atomic state in the beginning in a superposition of these two states, the evolution should be such that after the atom interact with the measuring apparatus, we should get an entangled state such that the red state here of the atom gets entangled with one of the positions of the pointer, and the green state gets entangled with the other, with this other position. Now, we can actually consider that the atom, after being detected, sticks to the measuring apparatus, so you have a new measuring apparatus with one more atom in it, and therefore we can consider this state as a superposition of two states of the apparatus. One in which the pointer is pointing towards that direction, the other the pointer is pointing towards this direction. These are distinguishable macroscopic states of the measuring apparatus. And of course, if we have a superposition like this, we can say two things. First, if we look at the apparatus, we are going to see the pointer pointing towards one direction or the other. This is actually equivalent to trying to discover through which slit a photon goes through in a Young experiment. So you find that it goes through one slit or the other. On the other hand, we know also that the fact that you have here coherent superposition means that we can have a complementary experiment, an interference experiment. And the question is, that we don't see these experiments in the lab. We have never been able to see an interference between two pointer states. And the question is then why this interference cannot be seen. And this question has been answered since the beginning of quantum mechanics in several different ways. Many people have evoked, for instance, superselection rules, according to which even if you have the pointer in a superposition state, you cannot measure the interference because you don't have non-local observables which could connect these two localized states. So even though the coherent state could be there, you would not be able to measure it. Now, more recently, the idea of decoherence has taken place and has been emphasized by Wojciech Zurek and other people like Caldera and Leggett and others. And the idea is that within a very short time, the measuring apparatus gets entangled with the environment. And because of that, this coherent superposition of two pointers gets in a very short time transformed into a statistical mixture. So you lose the ability to make an interference experiment. Now, this tells us that the decoherence time should be an important time scale in quantum mechanics. It would be interesting to watch this process by which the coherent superposition of these two macroscopically distinguishable states gets transformed into a statistical mixture. And what I'm going to show you today is that cavity QED allows the monitoring of the decoherence between classically distinct positions of a pointer. So let me then summarize what some important facts about cavity QED. We have, in general, two cavities, or two mirrors, say, a cavity, and these mirrors keep a field inside them. And this cavity is a very high-quality cavity. It has a very high Q. The Q of a cavity is defined as the product of the angular frequency of the mode times the lifetime of the field inside the cavity. So the larger the Q, the larger this lifetime. Now, experiments on cavity QED have been done in the microwave domain by Haroche's group in Paris and by Walter's group in Garching, and in the optical domain by people like Kimball and Rempe. I'm going to concentrate in this talk on experiments done in the microwave domain. And in this regime, you deal with superconducting cavities. They are made of niobium, and they are cooled down to temperatures of the order of 1 degree Kelvin. The lifetime of a photon inside the cavity actually depends on the geometry of the cavity. Walter's group uses a closed geometry, which means that you are able to keep the photon inside for a longer time. And by doing that, they reach lifetimes of the order of 1 second. They may reach those lifetimes. On the other hand, in Paris, experiments are done with open cavities, for which the lifetimes have been up to now of the order of 1 millisecond. Of course, you pay a price for having an open cavity, but you also gain something. And what you gain is the ability of applying a potential difference between these two mirrors here. So you can actually produce an electric field in this space between them, which is applied to the atoms which cross this field in the cavity. And this electric field allows to tune the atoms into or out of resonance, so that you can actually precisely calibrate the interaction time between the atoms and the field. This electric field has also another function. In fact, in order to measure this field and manipulate it, we use highly excited atoms. They are Rydberg atoms, and they are also called planetary Rydberg atoms. Their principal quantum numbers is of the order of 50, and the angular momentum of these atoms is n minus 1, so it's the maximum angular momentum allowed. And therefore, they are practically circular atoms. And because this electron is always very far from the nucleus, the lifetime of these atoms is very large. And you can even understand that classically, you are almost in the correspondence limit. So these electrons are very, they don't have a high acceleration because they are too far away from the nucleus, so they don't radiate too much. So you have a large lifetime, and the lifetime is of the order of 30 milliseconds. Now, also, if you deal with these highly circular atoms, the degeneracy is very high. So it's very easy to lose that state and to get it mixed up with other states. And that's why you apply an electric field to stabilize these atoms. Now, so this is the system which is used in these experiments. Now, these atoms will have a dispersive interaction with the field in the cavity. And what happens then is easy to understand classically. If you have a field confined in a cavity, the wavelength of the field being given in terms of the frequency by this relation here, where C is the speed of light inside the cavity. If you introduce now a transparent slab into the cavity, this slab will change the velocity of light inside the cavity. Now, the wavelength cannot change because it's because of the boundary conditions, so the frequency should change. So a transparent slab inserted into the cavity will result into a change of the frequency of the field. Now, quantum mechanically, it's also easy to understand it. You start with a coherent state inside the cavity, which is given in terms of Fock states by this expansion here. And then before interaction, you just have a product state between the atom in the E state, say, and the field. And then after the interaction, you get an extra phase factor here, which is just the Stark shift effect. In other words, this atom interacting dispersively with the field will produce an energy shift in the system. And this energy shift is proportional to the number of photons in the field. This is just second order perturbation theory. So you get an extra factor like that. And now, if you put this factor together with alpha, you recognize this as a phase shift coherent state. So the effect of this atom interacting dispersively with the field is just to produce a frequency shift in the field in precisely the same way as a transparent slab inserted into a cavity. Now, in these experiments, there are two possible level schemes which are used. One can use a three-level system, which is depicted in this figure. You have here these two levels, E and G. So the atom is injected into the cavity in one of these two levels. Now, you see that if the atom is in level E, there is a transition between E and I, which is off-resonant with cavity mode. So if the atom is in level E, there is a frequency shift of the field. The atom acts as a refraction index. On the other hand, if the atom is in level G is too far away from resonance, so nothing happens to the field in the cavity. So with this scheme, you can have an atom which acts like a phase shift switch. If the atom is in state E, the phase of the field is switched. If the is changed. If the atom is in state G, nothing happens to the field. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is to use a two-level atom such that this transition is, again, of resonance with a cavity mode. And in this case, frequency shifts will be induced for level E and for level G. However, they will be in opposite directions. So depending, again, on the state of the atom, there will be a different change of the field. Now, and you know, these level schemes are useful for one situation or the other. We can discuss afterwards in which situations they would specifically be useful. Now, so this is the system which was used to measure decoherence. We have here an atomic oven, which produces an atomic beam, which crosses this whole system of laser beams and cavities. Now, this is a set of exciting lasers and microwave sources, which actually place the atom in a very highly excited level, and they produce this planetary atom. This atom then, after being excited, goes through this region here, which has what we can consider as a classical field. Actually, the setup consisting of this cavity and this one is what is usually called a Ramsey setup. And we can consider that in these cavities, the atom interacts with a classical field. So what's going to happen with the atom is that the atom is going to, as a spin, to suffer a rotation under the action of this field. And we are going to consider the case in which this rotation is equal to pi over 2. It's like a spin 1/2, which rotates around a magnetic field, and this rotation is pi over 2. So E goes into E plus G over square root of 2, and G goes into minus E plus G over square root of 2. Then, you know, after being put in this state here, the atoms goes to the superconducting cavity, which is the cavity I mentioned before, where there is a field here, which can be injected with this microwave source. So in special, we can, for instance, produce inside the cavity a field which is very well represented by a coherent state. Then the atom goes again through a classical field region, and then one detects the state of the atom through this ionization detector. So one knows whether the atom exits in the E or in the G state, say, okay, depending on where it is ionized. So let us follow what happens with the atom as it goes through the system. So first, you know, let's consider that the atom has gone through this classical region so that it is put in this superposition state here, while the field in the cavity is in a coherent state. Okay? Now, you remember the transparency I showed you about the quantum measurement device, and you are going to recognize this state here as a state which I showed you there. Okay? Remember, I considered the atom in a superposition of the two states, and the pointer in the measuring apparatus was in the vertical position because the detection had not been made yet. Okay? So now let's see what happens with this atom. As it goes through this cavity here, you see it is going to have a dispersive interaction with the cavity field in such a way that the phase shift of the field will be different depending on whether the atom is in this state or this state here. And I'll consider here the two state case in which you have phase shifts in the opposite directions depending on the state of the atom. So the atom goes through the cavity, and you see now that we produce an entangled state between the atomic state and the cavity field with different phases. So again, we had a state like that in the transparency on the quantum measurement. That's the entangled state between the atomic state and the pointer. And the pointer here is represented by this coherent state in the cavity, which can have different phases. And the phase of the pointer is correlated with the atomic state. Now, at this point here, we could detect the state of the atom. And then nothing very interesting would happen. If we detect the atom in the E state, then we project the field onto a coherent state with this phase. If we detect the atom in the G state, then we project the field onto a coherent state with different phase. But you see, this is like an EPR experiment. We have these two systems which have interacted, and now they form an entangled system. And like in EPR experiments, we can choose what kind of measurement we do with one of the subsystems. So we can actually rotate the atom before measuring it. Okay? And if you rotate the atom by pi over 2, that means that this state here will be transformed into E plus G, this one into minus E plus G. So now we are going to have a state like this one, in which state E is now correlated with a difference between two coherent states with different phases, while the state G is correlated with a sum of two coherent states with different phases. It's clear now that if we measure the atomic state, we'll project the field in the cavity onto a superposition of two coherent states with different phases. And that's precisely equivalent to what we had in the transparency on quantum measurement, you know, the superposition of the measuring apparatus with two different pointer directions. So we get this kind of state. Now, this state is frequently referred to in the literature as a Schrödinger cat state. It's evidently a metaphor. Okay? It's not alive. Okay? And therefore, we know how to do this state. The question which comes now is how to measure it. If the people who told us about a super selection rule are right, then we are lost, right? We cannot measure it. So for some time,
question.
Yes. Yes.
Why is this system the same like a pointer? Because
yes.
This system is kept coherent, right?
Yes.
Now the pointer in some cell is a macroscopic system.
Yes.
And it's inside, well, can you design now for these atoms an echo experiment return them, and the state will return to the same state it was with before.
Sure, of course. Everything is unitary. So yeah, sure.
You cannot do it with the polygon.
Of course not, yes.
So why did you say that?
So that's the aim of this talk. Okay. So I'm going precisely to discuss this point now. Okay? So and that comes next. Okay? So it's clear that this is not a pointer as we know it, because pointers are not in coherent superpositions. And what we want to... Yeah, not even cats. So, and therefore what you want to do now is to try to measure this coherent superposition and see it disappear. That's our aim. Okay? Now, for some time we thought about this, you know, how can we measure this coherence and distinguish this coherent superposition from a statistical mixture. And then, you know, after we had the idea, it was obvious that it was quite simple. Okay? And the idea is that, you know, if you want to measure this cat in the cavity, of course you cannot put a photodetector there because it will completely spoil the cue of the cavity, it will destroy the field. Now, if you want to measure a cat in the cavity, of course the sensible thing to do is to send a cat to measure a mouse to measure the cat. And as everybody knows, a mouse is extremely sensitive to the state of a cat. Okay? So that's basically the idea of measuring this field in the cavity. So in order to detect the coherence, the idea was just send a second atom. And this was proposed in these papers, and I refer you to these papers for the details of the calculation. And what we get in the special case, in which the phase difference between the two states is equal to pi, okay, they're just, you know, opposed states in the phase space, is that if they are in a coherent superposition, the preparation and probing atoms are always detected in the same state. That is, if you detect the first atom, you know, the atom you detected to project, to prepare the state, if by chance you detected it in the E state, then the second atom will certainly be detected in the E state. And the same is valid for the G state. Okay? So there is perfect correlation between the measurements of the two atoms. And that's a signature of coherence in this state. On the other hand, if they are in a statistical mixture, the second atom is detected in E or G with a 50-50 chance. So in other words, the second atom forgets about what happened with the first one if you wait long enough. Okay? And this time between these two situations is precisely the decoherence time. Now, of course, this result opens an interesting perspective. We can prepare the field with the first atom and then delay sending the second atom, so that you can actually probe the state of the system as it evolves with time. Okay? And eventually, since dissipation is present, we would expect this coherent superposition to be destroyed and be transformed into a statistical mixture, a legitimate pointer situation. So we send the second atom, and we measure the state of the second atom. And we repeat this, of course, several times in order to build up statistics. If the second atom comes up always in the same state as the first one, there is no decoherence. On the other hand, you know, as you wait longer and longer, it will end up coming 50-50, you know, in E or G. And that's a signature of the mixture. So what has been shown for this special case, again, phi is the phase of each individual coherent state. So phi equal to pi over 2 means that you have two opposing phase coherent states. So for this special case, the situation for this mutual probability or conditional probability, if you want, it's the probability of detecting the second atom in the E or G state, provided the first one was detected in the E state. Okay? So the situation is the following. Look at this plot first. You see that if you send the second atom right after the first, there's perfect correlation between the two. This conditional probability is equal to 1. Okay? On the other hand, if you wait for some time, very quickly, this probability decays to this plateau, which is equal to 1/2. And after that, it decays to 0. Now, for PGE, you get a similar result. This is the conditional probability of detecting the second atom in the G state if the first one was detected in the E state. Now, if the system is coherent, we know that the second atom will be detected in the same state. So PG is equal to zero, but then it goes up very quickly to this 1/2 plateau, and then it decays to zero also. Now, one can actually calculate the details of this curve and show that the scale of time here, so the decoherence time, is equal to the damping time for the field in the cavity divided by the distance between the two coherent states in phase space. Okay. Now, another way of expressing this is through the amplitude square of the coherent state, and this is really the average number of photons in the coherent state. So this expression is actually very easy to understand physically. What it is telling us is that decoherence occurs at about the time it takes for a photon to leave the cavity. Now, the moment a photon, during this time, or at least after this time, the states of the field inside the cavity get entangled with orthogonal states of the field in the reservoir. So you don't have coherence for the field in the cavity anymore. Okay? So that's the idea. It takes one photon to leave, to get the coherence. Now, this part of the curve is also easy to understand. You see, after the coherence, you have this mixture of two states, but the field keeps leaking out of the cavity. So eventually, the field goes to the vacuum state. Now, if the field is in the vacuum state, remember the experimental setup. You first have the atom comes in the E state, and then there's a pi over 2 rotation. And then the atom goes through the cavity, which now has no field. It's in the vacuum state. And then it suffers another pi over 2 rotation. So if there is no field in the cavity, of course, if the atom comes in the E state, the final state of the atom will be the G state. Okay? And therefore, the probability, one has to have this behavior here. And this one here, we can understand just by exchange, I think, what I told you before. This is the probability of finding the second atom in the E state if the first was found in the G state, and not the opposite, as I said. Okay? So, and since the second atom will never be found in the E state, this goes to zero because, you know, it just suffers a pi rotation. Okay? Now, we have also shown that this whole setup has a big advantage. It is rather insensitive to atomic detection efficiency. And this is due to the fact that you have a dispersive interaction between the atom and the field. So we can show that even if you lose atoms, you'll be able to detect the decoherence, okay? As long as you don't lose many of them so that the field leaks out before you can measure the second atom. Okay? But it's highly insensitive, which in this within this framework is interesting because the detection efficiency they have now for these atomic states is about 50%. Okay? Now, what about the experimental results? They have been obtained in 1996 by Haroche's group at Ecole Normale. And you have here two sets of results for two different separations between the coherent states. These results here were obtained with the same average number of photons in the cavity, about 3.3, but the phasing was changed so that you could have different distances between the coherent states. And you see that indeed, with a larger distance, the two-atom correlation signal falls down more quickly. I should mention that this plot here is the plot of PEE minus PEG. That's the difference between the two curves I showed you before. So there is no plateau. Okay, you just look at the decoherence part. You subtract the rest. Okay, and the experimental results agree pretty well with the theoretical results. I should say that there is no adjustable parameter in these curves. Actually, they are calibrated by doing an independent Ramsey fringe experiment. Of course, the experiment is not perfect. There are many imperfections which should be taken into account. Stray fields, the atoms don't all find the same field because there is a modal distribution of the field in the cavity. But you can take those things into consideration by making an independent experiment. Therefore, you calibrate your apparatus and then you do this experiment. Okay. Now, at about this time, I was wondering with a student of mine, you know, what really this two-atom correlation experiment was telling us about the atomic state. It was telling us something. I mean, it allowed us to differentiate between the coherent superposition and the statistical mixture. But, you know, what part of the state was that? What kind of information was that giving about the state? Of course, it was partial information, and many different states would be consistent with this experimental data. So would it be possible, by using the same setup, to get complete information on the field state? What would that require? And in considering these questions, we came up with some answers. And in order to present to you these answers, I'll have to make a digression here on phase space representations. Now, suppose we want to describe a quantum state of a system with a phase space representation, which is as close as possible to a classical phase space representation. Now, so one thing we should require from this representation is that if we have, for instance, a distribution which depends on the position and the momentum of a particle in one dimension, if I integrate this distribution with respect to the momentum, I should find the position density distribution. You see that for a pure state, this is just this thing here. Now, if we integrate the distribution with respect to the position, we should get the momentum distribution. So in other words, a bona fide phase space distribution should yield me the correct marginal distributions for Q and P. Well, we should actually require more than that, because this property must remain true if the axes are rotated. So we should require that if we integrate this phase space distribution with respect to any direction in phase space, we should get the probability distribution for the orthogonal variable. Now, also according to quantum mechanics, this probability distribution here should be equal to the diagonal matrix element of the density operator in the rotated basis. So you see that this expression here has two parts in it. It's actually a set of two equations. We have one part which does not have anything to do with quantum mechanics. It is just telling us that if you have a distribution in phase space, you'd like the integral of one direction to give you the probability distribution for the other direction. So this is not quantum mechanical. It's a general requirement. And the second part is a quantum mechanical equation, which tells me that this probability distribution should be equal to this quantity. Okay. Now, the first part by itself is quite interesting, because you have here an integral transform. You start with a function of two variables, Q and P, and you get another function of two variables, Q and theta. So that's an integral transform. And what is very interesting is that since 1917, one knows that this integral transform can be inverted. In other words, if you know P of Q theta for all Qs and all theta, you can find W as a function of P of Q theta. It's an invertible integral relation. Okay. Now, so this remark that this relation here is invertible was actually made by a mathematician called Johann Radon in 1917. Okay. And this relation is called the Radon transform. So and the idea is that this distribution uniquely determines this function. And this inverse transform is called the Radon inverse transform. And you actually know about it, because this inverse transform is the basis of tomography. Okay? And here we have a situation which is completely analogous to the one I described before. You have this special system here, and then you send X-rays to it, and you detect here the integrated absorption of X-rays by the system. So you have here these straight line integrals which give you the absorption. And if you know all these integrated absorptions here, all these values here, using that and using the inverse Radon transform, you are able to find the density of this body here. Okay? So that's the principle of tomography. And for applying the Radon transform to medicine, Cormack and Hounsfield got the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1979. Now, it took a long time for this to be applied to quantum mechanics. And in fact, this was discovered by Bertrand, who published a paper in Foundations of Physics in 1987. Okay? And in this paper, they showed that if you use the second half of that equation, which relates P of Q theta to the density operator, you can invert it, of course, and therefore you can actually calculate W. And what they showed, you can calculate W as a function of the density operator. And what they showed was that this W for quantum mechanics is precisely the Wigner function, okay, which was introduced in 1932 by Wigner for calculating quantum corrections to classical statistical mechanics. It's funny because Wigner introduced that this distribution in 1932, and in his paper he said that, you know, he was picking up this distribution among several other possible distributions because, you know, it seemed to have some nice properties, and he actually spent a big part of his life trying to find a minimal set, not only that of course, but trying to find a minimal set of conditions which would lead to the Wigner function. And I think he would be very happy to know about the work of Bertrand and Bertrand, because the Wigner function comes out as a very significant distribution in phase space, since it is the only one which produces the correct marginal distributions for all directions. Okay? Now, if you then apply this Radom inverse transform, you get precisely the expression which Wigner had in 1932, which relates the Wigner distribution. He never called it there that way, with the density matrix. Okay, and you see that the Wigner distribution is a Fourier transform of the matrix elements of the density operator in the position basis. Now, the Wigner distribution has also other nice properties. It was shown in 1949 by Moyal that it is useful to calculate average of operators in symmetric form. Then, for instance, suppose you want to calculate the quantum mechanical average of xp plus px over 2. Then, with the Wigner function, you can calculate this average as if it was a classical average, replacing the operators x and p by c numbers. Also, since this is a Fourier transform relation, you can express the density matrix in terms of the Wigner function. So knowing the Wigner function is equivalent to knowing the density matrix, and that gives you full information about the state of the system. Now, this question is also related to an old question in physics. In his article on quantum mechanics in the Handbuch der Physik in 1933, Pauli formulated this question. Suppose you know the position and the momentum probability densities. Can you, from these densities, obtain the state of the system, the wave function? And at that time, he said that this question has not been investigated in all its generality. And now we know the answer. The answer is no, because these two sets do not form a tomographic complete set. You need the probability distributions for all other directions. Now, let me give you some examples of Wigner distributions. This is the Wigner distribution for a ground state of a harmonic. Yes?
We've certainly seen that they don't form a tomographic complete set for determining the density matrix. But if you add in the knowledge that the density matrix is at a pure state, does that change the situation?
No. You can actually give counterexamples which show that you cannot. Okay? It doesn't change. No. So, this is the Wigner function for ground state. It's a nice Gaussian. And if you plot it in terms of scaled x and p, so that the dispersions in x and p are equal, it's a symmetric Gaussian. This is the Wigner function for a Fock state of the harmonic oscillator, the n equal 3 eigenstate. And there you immediately see that even though the Wigner function is extremely nice in terms of yielding the correct marginal distributions, it cannot be considered as a probability distribution in phase space, okay? Because it can assume negative values. Okay? So this is, if you want, it's Heisenberg reminding you that x and p do not commute, and therefore one should not have a probability distribution in phase space in quantum mechanics satisfying all the requirements of a classical probability distribution. Now, if you have a mixture of two coherent states, then you just have two Gaussians. Each coherent state is represented by a Gaussian, so a mixture will give you just two Gaussians. On the other hand, if you have a coherent superposition of two coherent states. You see that you get fringes here around the origin of phase space. So by looking at the Wigner function, you can immediately distinguish between a statistical mixture and a coherent superposition of the two coherent states. Okay? So these fringes are the signature of coherent in this superposition. Now, several techniques have been proposed for the measurement of the Wigner function, and a very nice experiment was done in Weiland's group a while ago, in which they measured the Wigner function of a trapped ion. So you can consider that you have there an atom in a harmonic oscillator, and they were able to place this atom in precisely n equal to 1 state of the harmonic oscillator. And then they measured the Wigner function by using a method which I'm not going to discuss here. It's an indirect method. So the result they get is this one, a very nice experimental result, which shows the negative values of the Wigner function near the origin of phase space. So that's the Wigner function for an n equal to 1 eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator. And of course, if you have this Wigner function, you can immediately find the density operator from that. And the density matrix for the system is shown here. You see that really only the one n equal to 1 state is populated. There are some population also in other states due to experimental uncertainties. Now, knowing the Wigner function therefore characterizes the state, and because of these nice properties of yielding the correct marginal distributions and this relationship with classical phase space distribution, the Wigner function is actually a nice tool for looking at the classical limit of quantum mechanics. And this we can already see in this example. Here we have the superposition of two coherent states, like the ones which were produced in the cavity. Okay? And we would like to follow this superposition as it evolves with time. And it evolves with time because of the coupling of between this system and the reservoir. Because of this entanglement between the system and the reservoir. So we'd like to follow this evolution, and therefore it would be extremely nice to be able to measure the Wigner function, for instance, of that cavity field, which is placed in a superposition of two coherent states. Now, if you follow this superposition, then what you are going to see is that the fringes disappear within a very short time, and then, of course, the field leaks out of the cavity, so finally you get the ground state of the system. Okay? Now, the quantum classical the Wigner function is also useful to look at the quantum classical transition for classically chaotic systems. There has been lots of work done on that by Wojciech and Juan Pablo Paz. I will present you here an example of my own brand, some work which is being developed with a student, André, and a postdoc, Matos Filho. And what we look at is again the trapped ion, okay, which is submitted to a series of kicks, periodic kicks. And these kicks are produced by Raman lasers, which produce some transition, and that produces this kick. So you can mimic the situation with a classical equation of motion, which is like that. This gives you just the space dependence of these laser fields, which are used to produce the kick. The quantum mechanical Hamiltonian corresponding to this classical equation of motion is this one. And you see that you have here an important parameter, this eta here, which depends on the square root of h bar. And this parameter here is the so-called Lambdicke parameter. And in our case, it is the classicality parameter. It's interesting because it depends on this k, which is related to these Raman lasers. And this is the effective k, the projection of the k of the lasers along the direction of the trap. So you can actually go smoothly to the classical limit by changing the direction of the fields which produce the kick. So you really have a physical way here of going to the classical limit. And the classical limit is actually a double limit. You have to set eta going to zero, and the intensity of this interaction go to infinity, and so that this product here is constant and is equal to the classical amplitude. Now, the classical simulation, one of the classical simulations is shown here. This is the phase space distribution if you start with any initial Gaussian state for the system. And now we see the quantum simulation for the Wigner function. And you see that the results we get depend on two parameters. One is the Lambdicke parameter, which decreases in this direction. And the other is this gamma here, which quantifies the coupling of the system with the reservoir. which we have also in these calculations. Okay? So, and you see that, of course, in order to get close to the classical situation, you need both a small eta and a sufficiently important reservoir. So the reservoir helps the classical limit, as Wojciech has emphasized before. Okay? So again, look at the Wigner function, helps us to have some information about the classical limit in a very vivid way. Now, I have told you up to now on the phase space representation of particles, quantum oscillators, okay, characterized by the position and the momentum. How can we represent an electromagnetic field? Well, if you have a monomode electromagnetic field, you can express it in terms of a cosine and a sine component. And these amplitudes of the cosine and the sine are what we call quadratures of the field. Okay? You see that these quadratures are quite analog to the initial position and momentum of a harmonic oscillator. It's the same kind of relation. And in fact, when you go to quantum fields, in the same way as x0 does not commute with p0, q1 is not going to commute with q2. In fact, they are going to satisfy the canonical commutation relations. Okay? Now, if classically we don't know very well what q1 and q2 are, you can define a joint probability distribution of these quadratures, and with that you can calculate averages of fields of the field, for instance. Quantum mechanically, this phase space distribution here will be replaced by the Wigner distribution for q1 and q2. Now, in 1989, therefore 2 years after the work by Bertrand and Bertrand, but without knowing about it, Rieken and Vogel suggested to use a technique which was new in optics, the technique of homodyne measurement, which is used to measure quadratures of the field. So they said, okay, so we know how to measure a quadrature of the field using homodyne detection. So if we know that, we can retrieve the Wigner function of the field. So they suggested that, and 4 years after this suggestion, the first measurements of the Wigner function of electromagnetic fields were done in Raymer's group. And so this is the Wigner function for a squeeze state, this is for the vacuum state, and their efficiency, their detection efficiency is very low for these experiments. Better resolution experiments, or better efficiency experiments were done later by Mlinek's group. And you see here some very beautiful Wigner functions displaying squeezed states. Okay? Now, this, of course, is the quadrature measurement, but I'm not going to go into these details here. Now, you see that these measurements have actually measured positive Wigner functions. They're all Gaussians. And in this sense, you know, it's a very nice thing. But some people are saying, oh, okay, so you don't need quantum mechanics to describe these fields. You know, you can use a classical distribution in phase space with some noise. And that's it. So we wanted very much to measure a negative valued Wigner function. But of course, we had some problems. There were some problems in the experimental setup, which I'm going to describe later. And what we could do last year was just to measure the value of the Wigner function at the very origin of phase space. And then what we were able to show is that the one photon Wigner function was negative at the origin of the phase space, while the vacuum Wigner function was positive at the origin of phase space. Okay? But of course, it would be much nicer to get the full picture. And this full picture was, and I'm going to explain the method which was used in this experiment in a while. The full picture was obtained very recently by Mlinek's group. So they measured the Wigner function of one photon state using a pair of photons, which are produced by down conversion in a crystal. And they used one of the photons in the pair as a trigger for doing homodyne measurement on the other photon, okay, so that they guarantee that there is only one photon. And the Wigner function, which they measure, is this one. You see that there is clearly some negative region here. They get an overall efficiency for this measurement of 55%, still low, and they're trying to improve it. Now, I have told you about many indirect ways of measuring the Wigner function, and somehow the fact that all these indirect ways are present reinforce the idea that the Wigner function cannot be directly measured, that you cannot have direct access to a point of the Wigner function in phase space because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And I was never able to understand very well this argument because, of course, that principle only says that you cannot measure the Wigner function by measuring simultaneously Q and P with arbitrary accuracy, but maybe you can imagine another way of getting to that point in phase space and measure the value of the Wigner function there. And indeed, we made a proposal together with Lutherbach, who was a PhD student, to measure directly the Wigner function of an electromagnetic field in a cavity. And this proposal was based on the following expression for the Wigner function, which is due to Kahiller and Glauber, as far as I know. And this is the same Wigner function we had before, but now instead of being expressed in terms of X and P, it is expressed in terms of creation and annihilation operators. These alphas here are complex amplitudes. You know, alpha is something like X plus IP. It's a combination of X and P. So you can express the Wigner function in this way. And this is a very suggestive way to express it. You see, you have here this displacement operator, which is applied to this density operator of the field you want to measure. And then you have another operator here, which is the parity operator. If you apply this operator to X or P, you get minus X and minus P. So it's a parity operation. And therefore, the Wigner function is expressed in this way in a very compact form. It's just, if you want, you can formulate it in this way. It is the average of the displaced parity operator. Or if you want, it's the average of the parity operator in the displaced field state. It's equivalent. Okay? Now, the normalization of this Wigner function differs from the previous normalization. We can show that this Wigner function is bounded by 2. And also, the same symmetry properties apply, in the sense that if you want to calculate this, the quantum average of this symmetric combination of operators, it is given by this classical expression here. Now, so we looked at this expression, and we realized that we can actually implement this expression. It's like making an analogic computation with cavity QED. Why is that? Well, you see, we have the parity operator. Look at this operator here. This is an energy operator. So it's like the phase, it's like a phase shift operator, corresponding to a phase shift equal to pi. Now, we know how to produce phase shifts in the cavity field. We just have to send an atom which has a dispersive interaction with the field. So this part we know how to deal with. Now, the other part is this displacement operator. In order to understand it better, first, you know, you should realize that the reason why it's called displacement operator is that it really translates position and momentum in phase space. In fact, you just have to express NA and AG in terms of X and P, and you see that this is a combination of a translation operator in X and a translation operator in P. Second remark, which is important about this operator, is that it can also be seen as an evolution operator, corresponding to an interaction Hamiltonian, which is linear in A and A daga. And this interaction can be understood as the one of a classical of a quantum harmonic oscillator with a classical force, or if you want, of a quantum mechanical electromagnetic field with a classical current. It produces an interaction like this one. So I can now say that we know how to produce a displacement. In order to displace a field in a cavity, you connect it to a microwave source, and you just turn on the microwave. Okay? The microwave is a classical current which is going to displace the field. So we know now how to measure the Wigner function in a cavity. You use the same setup which one had before, the same one which was used to measure the coherence. And now suppose we have inside the blue cavity, that's the superconducting cavity, we have a field which we want to measure. Okay? So first thing we have to do is to displace the field. Okay? So in order to displace the field, turn on the microwave so that the field is displaced precisely by some complex amplitude alpha. Then you send an atom through the system so that this atom has a dispersive interaction with the field in the cavity and displaces the phase of the field by pi. Then you detect the atomic state. Okay? Then, of course, you produce the field anew, the field you want to measure, and repeat the procedure because you need to build up statistics. And what we have shown is that if you do that, then you can show that the difference between the probability of finding the atom in the upper state after it leaves the whole system and the probability of finding the atom in the G state is precisely equal to the value of the Wigner function at the point minus alpha conjugate of phase space, where alpha was the displacement you applied to the field, divided by 2. Okay? And by the way, this gives a nice physical demonstration of the bound on the Wigner function, because since PE minus PG is between 1 and minus 1, the Wigner function should be between 2 and minus 2. So, now, we had a problem to apply this immediately, and the reason is that, you see, you need a phase shift equal to pi. And you remember that in the coherence experiment, the maximum phase shift was of the order of pi over 2. In order to get a phase shift equal to pi, you need slower atoms, which they have now, but they didn't have at that time. On the other hand, if you want just to measure the Wigner function at the origin for a 1 or 0 photon state, there is another thing which you can do. You send through the cavity this three-level atom, and before the atom crosses the cavity, you place the atom in a superposition of the states, say, G and I. And you consider that if there is one photon in the cavity and the atom is in state G, then the atom interacts resonantly with this photon field so that it has a 2-pi rotation. Now, since it's a two-level system, it's like a spin, this 2-pi rotations produces a minus sign. So you see, you get the sign you wanted for one photon in the cavity, and for the atom in this state here, the state of the system changes. While if the atom is in state I, nothing happens. Also, if there are zero photons in the field, nothing happens as well. So now we have not displaced the field because we are looking at the Wigner function at the origin of phase space, but we have the phase shift operator in a resonant way, which is easier to do than the dispersive interaction, which takes more time. Okay? So this was done, and this was the method used to, well, some animation, but anyway. So this was the method used to measure the Wigner function at the origin of phase space, and which actually it was possible to show that the value is negative for one photon state. You should also recognize that we have here phase gate. This is a conditional measurement. Okay? So if the atom, if there is one photon in the cavity, the state, the atom is in the state G, there is a change of sign. Otherwise, there is no change of sign. So it's funny that the same experiment, which is used to build a phase gate, which is a very basic operation in quantum computation, is the same setup which is used to measure a very basic quantity in quantum mechanics, namely a negative value of the Wigner function in phase space. These are the measured values for the vacuum and for the one photon state. Now, what comes next? Of course, we can talk about several things, but I'll just make a selection for you. The fact that it's selection by no means means that these are the most important problems. They are just problems which came to mind. One thing which would be nice to do would be experiments with two cavities, and the idea is the following. You can have, for instance, this kind of setup. We now have two superconducting cavities, and we have this, you see, this pi rotation of the atom in between. And now you see what happens. Suppose we inject coherent states in these two cavities here. Now, if the atom, and then, I mean, you send an atom through the cavity. Now, if the atom is in the E state, suppose also you have a three-level system. So if the atom is in the E state, there is a phase shift of the field. If it is in the G state, nothing happens to the field, okay? So suppose the atom is in the E state, what happens? Well, it will shift the phase of the field here, but not here. On the other hand, if the atom is in the G state, nothing will happen to the field here, but then the atom will be transferred to the E state here, and it will change the phase of the field there. So with this scheme, you can produce a state like this one, an entangled state of two coherent states in the two different cavities. And now, if you displace this state with this coherent source, you transform, you displace it by alpha, you zero this minus alpha here, so you transform the state into this one. And this is a funny kind of state. It's a state in which one of the cavities is lighted, but you don't know which one. Okay, you have a superposition of a lighted cavity and a dark one. Okay? And this system is interesting for several reasons. First, you realize that now we have really a realization in space of the measuring apparatus. Okay, this is a pointer, you know, spatially localized, which measures the state of this two-level system. Okay. Second, you can consider this as a Young experiment. Look, you have this coherent state, which can be either here or here, right? This is like a two-slit Young experiment. Now, with the difference that you don't have one photon which can be in one slit or the other, you have a coherent state which can be in one slit or the other. So it's a Young experiment with coherent states. Okay? And in Young experiment, of course, we take the beams and then we take them to the screen to see interference. Here we cannot do that, so we take the screen to the field. In other words, we let an atom go through the system. So the atom is sensitive to these two fields. So the atom is a screen. And by the way, the atom is also the non-local operator, which we use to measure this coherence between the two spatially localized fields. So this would be a Young experiment with coherent states. And of course, the de Broglie wavelength here is different from the usual de Broglie wavelength because you have many photons in each packet. Okay? So this is similar to a proposal by Yamamoto on using another equipment. And also, you know, this interference fringes, which depend on the number of photons, are nothing else than the fringes of the Wigner function. They are related to those, which also depend on the number of photons there. The frequency is higher if the distance between the two coherent states increases. So one is related to the other. And last but not least, you know, this system, the same setup, can be used to make a teleportation experiment with two-level atoms. This entangled field in the two cavities is a teleportation machine. So you send a two-level atom through the first cavity, and then you can reproduce its state on a second atom which crosses the other cavities. And in view of one of the last seminars by Carl, you know, this could be the first teleportation experiment. But, you know, these two cavities. Okay, so you know that's a nice question because in the way I'm explaining it, it looks like there is, you know, the distance is irrelevant. And in fact, if you look at the decoherence of the state here, it depends only on the magnitude of alpha. It does not depend on the distance. The problem, of course, is that in order to produce the state and in order to measure it, you have to send an atom which crosses the two cavities before it decays. Okay? And this limits the distance. Well, it's easy because you see the lifetime of this atom, let's calculate, is 30 milliseconds. Okay? And its velocity may be, it's of the order of 500 meters per second in some experiments. So you have to see what distance they could go before they decay. But, you know, in practice, if you want really to know in practice, you have to refrigerate these cavities. And they'll probably be in the same refrigeration chamber, so you have some centimeters between them. Okay. Now, another application, and I don't know if I'm going to talk about that on Thursday.
No.
Okay. So, another possible application which came to mind while I was here was the measurement of sub-Planck structures in phase space. And it was proposed by Wojciech in a recent Nature paper. And the idea is the following. You correct me if I'm not right. So, you produce now four coherent states. Okay. In a superposition of the four. So you get these interference fringes here, like you had before, between each pair. But also the center, in the central region, you get this checkerboard pattern. And it's very easy to show that if alpha of this coherent state is larger than one, the structure of each pattern here is smaller than the so-called elementary cell in phase space. Okay, H bar. Okay. So, you know, people sometimes say that you don't have access to these regions in phase space, and with the Wojciech paper, it was clear that they are very important. And in fact, you know, here you can produce the state in cavity QED with two atoms. The first atom meets a coherent state and separates it into two coherent states. And then you send a second atom, which separates with a different phase shift, which separates each of these coherent states into other coherent states. So you immediately get this four coherent state superposition. And then we know that we can measure the Wigner function. So you can actually have access to this sub-Planck structure and measure it directly in this kind of experiment. Okay. Now, some further questions, just to finish it. I'm just talking about this question like that, you know, things which occur to me. This is a simple system, and it would be a nice system to actually develop a full detailed decoherence theory, in the sense that this field which is in the cavity is interacting with the electrons in the mirrors. Now you see, if you have a coherent superposition of two fields with different phases, they should be correlated with different electronic currents in the mirrors with different phases. So this sort of reminds us of your experiment with this superposition of currents, but we can actually calculate these currents in this case and find that the two states are practically superimposed. The scalar product of them is 1 minus epsilon. So the system really does not get entangled with them. But this is not the full answer, because we know that there is decoherence after all. So we should follow the process still further and ask what happens now with the states. How do they couple with the external world? So as far as I know, the full decoherence theory in this, along these lines, has not been developed yet. Okay? And I think it would be an interesting exercise, especially in view of these other experiments, which are very interesting too, and which one would like to fully understand. Now, the other thing which can be done is to measure the Wigner function of entangled modes. They can actually now produce entangled states of two modes inside the cavity, so that you have one photon in one of the modes and you don't know which. Of course, with two cavities, you can do the same thing. And I showed that as an example. And you can measure the Wigner function of this two-mode system by a trivial generalization of what I said before. You just displace the two modes independently. And then you send an atom which has a dispersive interaction with the two modes. And that gives you the Wigner function of the ensemble of two modes. And then the question is, by looking at the Wigner function, can you characterize the entanglement of the state? Okay? How can you do it in a very economical way, if possible, okay, so that you don't have to measure the full Wigner function of the system, which is never possible, of course. Right? You just get a set of points. And finally, there is the problem of taming the coherence. Can we control the coherence? Are there schemes within this framework to reduce its effect on the state of the system? There has been some work along these lines, but I think there are much more to be done. Now, as conclusions of this talk, I think I hope to have shown you that cavity QED allows a detailed study of the coherence. The Wigner function of a field in a cavity can be directly measured and allows the monitoring of the coherence, of the decoherence process. And finally, we can think of new proposals for investigation of non-local fields and localization in configuration space and measurement of sub-Planck structures. Thank you very much.
Baffled by the point that you made that created in my mind as well, that the decoherence time for this new Schrodinger cat state is independent of the distance between the two cavities. How can I understand that? I would have some way that, well, there's a question of distinction. The decoherence disappears as a scheme becomes entangled with another degree of freedom.
Yes.
So there's, in some sense, extra distinguishability I would have expected from the fact that I can tell from which cavity
the
cat has leaked out of.
Right.
Resolution.
Perfect. Yes, very good.
The decoherence time would decrease exponentially fast as these cavity modes.
Yes,
are.
Right.
Why is that?
Okay, very good, very good, very good, very good point. So, very good point, especially since we thought about it before, you see. And I didn't offer you a beer tonight, right, for asking that question. So. No, it's like that. Actually, you know, this worried us because, you know, it's the same questions you asked. And the answer is the following. What's the mechanism of decoherence in this case? Well, it's very easy to understand. You see, you have one of the cavities is lighted, but you don't know which one. Now, it is sufficient for one photon to leak out for you to know which one has a field. Okay? So again, it's the time one photon takes to leak out of the cavity. That's the decoherence time. Now, if the cavity, now what and how can you distinguish from which cavity the photon came out? Well, roughly by the wavelength of the photon, say. Okay? So indeed, if you get the cavities closer to each other, so that their distance is of the order of the wavelength, you'll not be able to tell from which cavity the photon left. And therefore, the decoherence time will be greatly reduced, of course. But then in that situation, you see, in each of the cavities, you have a mode of the field. And it's not even the lower state, but even if it was, as you approach the cavity so that the distance is comparable to the wavelength, that means that they will start to share the mode. They will be transforming to just one cavity. So what we can say is that now, when we're describing this experiment, we are beyond the regime in which the decoherence depends on the distance. Mm-hmm. Now it only depends on the magnitude of the fields. It does not depend on the distance anymore, because the two cavities are already distinguishable by photon emission. So if you want to probe that, you know, I thought of that because that could be an interesting way to probe this distance dependence, but no way with this setup.
What is the decoherence time?
It's the dissipation time of the cavity.
Which is?
Oh, that's about, you know, in the last experiments they have made, it's about 1 millisecond. Yeah.
Divided
by the amplitude square of the field, by the average number of photons in the field, which is the time it takes for one photon to leak out. Okay? There are some factors of 2, which you can actually calculate by elementary reasoning. Because why 2? Because, you know, in this system here, of course, the photon has 1/2 of chance of being, I mean, this cavity has 1/2 of chance of being lighted, 1/2 of chance of not being lighted. So you have to put that 1/2 in when you calculate this lifetime of the photon, and then you come up with the correct result. So it's about 1 millisecond divided by the average number of photons in the cavity.
But the bottom line of this is that this cavity, that this decoherence time is the same as the original Arroche experiment.
It is.
The same magnitude of alpha.
Yes, it is. It is the same.
If I could extend the discussion further. See, this point is lost in the usual calculation of the coherence.
Mm-hmm.
Because they usually assume that the system moves in a coordinate x, and the environment lives in a space of coordinate q.
Mm-hmm.
So these two don't live in the same space.
Yes.
Right? And then you get this quadratic dependence of decoherence and separation forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you recognize it and do the calculation explicitly, what you get initially quadratic, but at the time, as Luis has specified, where the separation is of the order of the coherence in the environment,
right,
you end up flattening out.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a saturation.
Yes.
The paper by Angin et al.
Yes.
Takes apart some of these assumptions, which are giving simple results, but are not always justified.
And we are in this plateau regime.
Yeah.
We are checking, and this plateau depends on the amplitude of the field.
So if you could extend that lifetime, you could prepare this current state and then transport half of it. Mile away.
Yes. Yes. Actually, we'll have to.
Right.
Send it in the mail. Yeah. Yes. Right. Quantum Amtrak. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, let's thank Luis again for.